Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 89, we'll be talking to a foreign correspondent who's just back from covering the recent events in North Africa.
If you talk to anybody who's ever based in the Middle East, they always tell you that the story comes back and bites you in the behind, because it's a story that ebbs and flows, and sometimes it blows up and it's huge, and then for a year or two, it's completely quiet.
That was Nahla Ayed, foreign correspondent with the CBC. And as a provocative new report on the future of architecture is launched in London, we'll be asking, will architects still exist in 2025?
The future is probably very interesting and bright for people who train as architects, but that may not be quite so true of traditional design-led architectural practice.
That was Dickon Robinson, chair of the think tank Building Futures at the Royal Institute of British Architects. And later in the program, we'll be talking to Greg Lindsay, co-author of the new book, Erotropolis, about the cities of the future.
The urban footprint of Earth is going to double in 19 years. So it really raises the question of, you know, that perhaps a sense of place and a sense of distinctiveness is going to be the ultimate luxury in the 21st century.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, March 6, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London with me, Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
That's
Hello.
How we do it, nice and quick.
Yeah.
Keep it pacey. Let's do the show. We've only got five minutes.
It's a 15-minute show today. That's it.
Okay, that's good.
How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Okay, right. How are you, Andrew?
I'm very good.
We all did run here, didn't we, as well?
Exactly.
That's good.
We should do maybe a program in the park, sort of with a, you know, exercise breakout or something for
a
Sunday morning.
Jogging and talking, that might be a bit of a push for
I could do that.
Sunday morning.
I could do that. Okay. I found my zone recently. Do you know that?
What you? Where should we go with this? 47,000 questions I want to ask you.
Okay,
we've only got 15 minutes.
Okay,
we've
shoot,
only got
go,
30.
Go.
Where was it?
Yeah.
Well, I found my particular zone in St. Moritz, and I was working out with my trainer over the Christmas holidays. It's a while ago now, but I'm still in my zone. It has an Italian name. You go on a treadmill. They take your blood every 5 seconds, and then they tell you what your heart rate range you're supposed to work out within. Mine's between 127 and 145.
That sounds impressive.
It's not that impressive. It's actually rather slow around the park, I have to say. That's why.
Is that heartbeats or miles per hour?
But that's why I think we could do the program jogging and talking at the same time, because when you're in your zone, you're able to talk the whole time. I mean, I could run and run and run.
I might run that. And Rob, can you run and run, run?
I'm still trying to find my spot. I'm having lots of
it's
fun
trying.
It's
not called trying.
Your spot. Oh, sorry.
It's called it was, your zone.
That's exactly the problem with this sort of conversation.
Andrew, you?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not a very good runner. I've got very good knees.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. I mean, they look fine to me.
So I'm not
Andrew,
sure.
Likes, you're excited about summer coming. Yeah. Andrew likes a short in the office, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
I don't know. Let's just be clear. I'm the one person who hasn't worn shorts in the office.
You often wear shorts.
I often wear a short. I've seen you. Maybe you have worn shorts in the office.
What's the difference between shorts and a short? It sounds like you've only got one short leg and one long leg on.
Keeping it gangster.
Exactly. What's going on the other side, I wonder? Yeah. Got like a sleeveless number. How are you settling into the new office? We're moving into week number three now.
I love the new office. The new office is good in that everyone has a desk. There's actually kind of space. Rob seems all kind of calm and happy in the new office.
And Rob's
good.
Rob's surprised. You have, in the upcoming issue, you have a big piece on the radio business, surprisingly.
Indeed.
And have you found the magic machine yet? Because I know there's an audition has been going on for our chosen audio device.
Well, we've been running some auditions in the office. Some of them sound better than others. Some of them look better than others. Some look great but don't sound very good, and vice versa.
Mm.
So I'm still trying it out.
Is the Denon CD player? Is it sad?
No, it's made a bit of a comeback this week.
Well, the trouble is with all the others, you probably need to read the instructions, which no one seems very willing to do.
No, well, that's the problem. And then also there's the other problem with the other machines, where you plug an iPod into the top of them. Mm. You play iPod Rodeo, which is basically where you put someone's iPod on the machine, and you have, you know, the winner is the one whose iPod lasts the longest.
But
there's been a lot of criticism. You know,
it's time to do a TV audition though, because we're without television still. We've got space for 1, 2, 3, 4 televisions on our editorial floor, and it's just plug outlets and
cables hanging out.
Everyone's still busy looking out the window. That's the
no, I know. Thing. I think there's yeah, and we haven't had enough time. There's been no France fan cap. There's only been Al Jazeera at home, and yeah, not even well, BBC on your laptop.
Yeah, I've missed. With so many things going on, I've actually missed the TV the last few weeks.
Which is probably why it's a good reason to bring in Nahla Ayed from the CBC. Recently back from Cairo, correct?
That's right.
And you're on the ground, I guess, just sitting in standby mode in London?
I am, and monitoring, as right. You know, lots of sources to monitor. So we're watching Twitter, we're watching Facebook, we're watching the blogs, and just trying to figure out what's next.
I mean, before we actually talk about where things go, and Andrew, I know that we've been having sort of an ongoing discussion in the office, and we're working on quite a big piece about who are the winners and the losers in terms of capitals out of all of this. And, you know, I think we've certainly seen European capitals and also Washington as well being slightly on the back foot in all of this. And who's really also come out on tops. And it's interesting because, you know, we've had this discussion about, you know, a lot of focus on, you know, is this a Facebook revolution? And I think we sort of came to the conclusion that this is still a revolution that was televised.
It was very much televised. And interestingly, in Egypt, it was initially just televised on the big networks, like the big Arab networks, but not on the local network. As you remember, this was a point of contention with some of the people there, is that, listen, our state TV pretends there's nothing going on. But then the state TV clued in and realized who was winning, and they started to report it. And it was very much a TV thing. And don't forget, phones were disabled and internet was disabled. So how could it be really an internet or Facebook or Twitter revolution when you don't have the means to do it? So really, it was word of mouth. It was just the expectation that every day people are supposed to just come out, and that's what they did.
Andrew, do you sometimes feel that it is not even just news editors on the floor, but it's potentially people sitting in the finance department of these major news gathering organizations saying, you know, oh, well, these seem like less expensive news gathering sources. So let's just sort of keep on. If we beat people over the head enough about Facebook and Twitter, then we don't have to have any correspondents anymore.
Yeah, it's strange. You see people kind of, you know, sending a kind of tweet that kind of appears on your TV screen and kind of takes up kind of a lot of mileage. And again, you know, there's always this thing of, you know, who sent it and what the authenticity of, you know. And it, you know, obviously it is a very cheap form of news. I think what's also interesting is alongside the TV stuff is what's that kind of revolution in print, which you must have seen there, you know, that actually newspapers that were pro Mubarak suddenly say, actually, do you know what, we can't carry on unless we start reporting what's really going on. I thought it was actually the traditional media that actually began to frame what was going on across the whole Maghreb.
I was actually at the newspaper just after Mubarak fell, actually, and it was really interesting. We had asked for permission to go in and just film, because I thought one of the most interesting things was this paper, who's been around for 100 years, was going to change entirely. Was it going to be a smooth process? And sure enough, we walk in and we were told, well, you can try if you want. And we were stopped at the door, and you could hear the arguments. They were fighting in the newsroom about where the paper should be going and how, what should be on the front page the next day, and they actually came to blows. It was really interesting.
Rob, do you think maybe that's actually one of the unexplored stories? That, you know, I think every time you have something flare up, and just the space or the speed at which electronic media moves, that there is sort of the focus on the story of the day, but this has also been, you know, very much about, you know, as Andrew's saying, you know, a media revolution, and certainly media revolution as it pertains to politics in the region.
Yeah, I think that that is the sort of unexplored story behind the story, is, you know, is how people have been receiving their news in the countries that have been affected by this sort of tidal wave of stuff. And, you know, for the first time, as you're talking about, you know, arguments in newsrooms, people can tell the truth. And you wonder, after a 100-year history of a newspaper that's sort of been maybe potentially towing a particular line, how easy it is.
It's not easy, because obviously it's been built around a regime. And so the guy on top is one of Mubarak's friends. And in fact, I believe one of the officials there were actually part of Mubarak's party. And so how do you take that massive ship and turn it around?
It's one thing to look at certainly the Middle Eastern media. I'm also wondering, though, we're sitting in London, which, you know, really has become the only, certainly for the US networks, this is just the one place that the US networks are based, where they still have a presence, you know, the Rome bureaus, the Moscow bureaus, I mean, all of that stuff, you know, the flyaway satellite dishes that used to be based at Frankfurt Airport, all of that's gone now. And as much as we've been sort of talking about sort of capitals being on the back foot, I'm also wondering, you know, in the case of a lot of news gathering organizations, wasn't something where you're having a discussion with the State Department and how are you going to have embeds, et cetera. This, you know, this just blew up. And I'm wondering, when you were out on the road and talking to some of your other North American colleagues, you know, was this something where they were also caught off guard and thinking, I wonder if we were a little bit understaffed, we perhaps cut back too early in London, or we simply just don't have a Cairo bureau anymore?
Well, I think if you talk to anybody who's ever based in the Middle East, they always tell you that the story comes back and bites you in the behind, because because it's a story that ebbs and flows. And sometimes it blows up and it's huge. And then for a year or two, it's completely quiet. And so I think everybody who's ever, including myself, who's lived in the region has said, yes, you've cut back too fast. And you know what? This is going to come back and haunt you. And so very much every colleague I came across either had been based in the Middle East, or they used to have a Jerusalem bureau and an Arab bureau. And the Arab bureau was gotten rid of because it seemed pretty quiet after, you know, all the stuff that happened. Basically, the last thing was 2009, Gaza, you know, the conflict between Hamas and Israel. And so companies felt, well, there's no reason to keep this all here. But now you think all that infrastructure, all those contacts and fixers and cameras that you bringing into the Arab world is really hard. You know, equipment is hard to bring in. So there's a lot of regret about that, I think.
And do you think this is good news for news organizations? Because it did look particularly strange, I think, over the last, you know, really over the last week when you had a two-way between sort of New York or Atlanta and then Jerusalem. But the stories, you know, in Tripoli.
Well, God, how much reporting was going on from so much further away than that, you know, that it seemed to be so displaced where the reporting was coming from. We have a young guy who reports for us, Jack Schenker, out of Cairo, and it's interesting to see the amount of work that he got for all sorts of, you know, media, just because he was based in the city. And actually, you realise that where there would have been all these correspondents, you know, 10 years ago, they've just gone. And so suddenly there is a real role for somebody like that.
I'm also wondering if that's also part of it too, because, you know, when you look at, you know, the role that London or Washington did or didn't play as the story played out, it's also part of it is also having, you know, your own people out there on the ground as well in the lead up, no?
Yeah, and it's one thing to have your own people on the ground and one thing to have your own people who have been on the ground, because you really have to understand the story. I found, and I'm not trying to be immodest here, but I think anybody based anywhere could say this to you, is that I found that people would say, wow, how'd you know that? And it's like, well, I lived in the Middle East for 7 years. That's how I knew that, as you would about London or as anybody would in another city. And so it's having people on the ground from the perspective of your own country, let's say a Canadian point of view in my case, but also people who know the terrain they're on. Because you could send 100 journalists to a place, and journalists are fast learners and they can learn a lot, but the nuances, especially in the Middle East, of course, I'm biased because that's my area of expertise, you can only learn if you've lived there.
Absolutely. Rob, is it, one way, perhaps, you know, good news for traditional news gathering organizations, but I was going to say, it must have been a boon for fixers. I mean, anyone who is a fixer right now, especially at a time when, you know, all those people were sort of gone, I can only imagine that, you know, people were commanding some rather handsome prices.
Yeah, anyone with a Land Cruiser and a kind of decent mobile phone, let alone a satellite phone.
Yes.
And a couple of languages to their name would be, rolling in it.
Was that the case? I think we've all sort of known fixers all over the world, and in the, you know, that era of cutbacks, you know, they're all sort of let go from the NBC bureau wherever, and rather disgruntled as well. And then the phone rings, and okay, well, if I'm going to come and get you in my Mercedes, this is what's going to cost today,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And they're the first to say, "We told you so."
Yes.
They're the first. I mean, even people that we know, you know, have said, you know, we told you, you could have stayed here, we could have all stayed employed, and you would have gotten your news. No, you had to cut us, and now we have to come back. But no, obviously it is a very lucrative business. And again, in fits and starts, because before all of this, I know a number of fixers who've become, you know, lifelong friends who said to me that they're really hurting for work. So really, they're just making up for lost time right now.
Yeah. Let's look at the pouring of foundations. And if that's, you know, even what's happening, you know, whether we're, you know, talking about Tunisia or, you know, Egypt or Libya. But, you know, let's focus on Libya. Last week, you know, some reports are saying that Egyptair, you know, a new member of, you know, Star Alliance, you know, and, you know, a serious global carrier, you know, was probably going to have to cut back 40% of its fleet just because tourism, hotel bookings, they've just dropped off a cliff. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, the principal money spinner, okay, fine, you were across the way in Lebanon, but, you know, how long do you think it's going to take, and who is going to take the reins? Will someone even take the reins in the interim? Because this is what's going to have to keep this economy ticking over.
You mean politically, who's going to take
well,
over?
Well, politically, or even, you know, even sort of a step down in terms of the various, you know, ministries, etc. Is there enough leadership to actually just keep them going as sort of a business as usual right now?
Well, I mean, for one thing, they do have some pretty smart people and with it people at the tourism industry. And I think given the fact that Egypt, especially Egypt's poor, depends so much on the tourism industry, all those people who serve you at the restaurants and who carry your bags at the hotels, I mean, they're all among the poorest of the poor in Egypt. I think, again, the same acknowledgement on Mubarak's part that led him to step down, which is that he doesn't want his people to starve, I think does exist among the people who understand how important tourism is in the country. And so I think actually maybe the tourism ministry might be leading the way on some of this stuff, because they know if they don't, people will be very hungry and they'll be very angry, and that's not good because it'll mean more unrest in the country.
Mm. I mean, Andrew, we have a piece coming up on the Suez, and when you look at also just the administering of the Suez as well, is that something that can also live slightly in isolation? And this is, you know, this is going to be coming in our April issue, or not?
Well, the Suez has lots of problems which are not just connected with the revolution. They have problems that, you know, the mouth to the Suez in the south is kind of surrounded by pirates. They have problems that the Arctic ice cap is melting and ships are thinking about heading north. They have a problem that, you know, shipping is just not actually needing to come through there now because it's heading to India and China within Asia. So they're, you know, they're threatened, but they're not really threatened by the revolution. But I think what's interesting for the tourism industry is if things settle down reasonably quickly, they could be okay, because you've seen it after even events like Bali, in fact, where there's some terrible kind of shock to the system that, in fact, people will often vote in almost sympathy, will come back and say, actually, we need to go there, we need to kind of support it. I think for what's interesting from an industry point of view or from a commercial point of view is you do wonder what will happen to Libya, even if everything gets settled very quickly and Gaddafi goes, because just the number of people that it was dependent upon working as migrant workers, as skilled people, they've all gone. There's actually no one to run the oil refineries. There's no one to kind of do all of the tasks that actually brought money into that economy.
A lot of them Egyptians, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. And so, that you think, God, that could take months and months and months to pull people back.
But you're right, because Lebanon is the case. As you know, violence comes and goes there like the weather here. And it is a place that people always flock back to when it's over. I mean, of course, in lesser numbers, but there are people who just they love Lebanon and they'll come back no matter what. As soon as the conflict is over, you know, half the Gulf is over, you know, to have drinks and to hang out and to listen to music. So I think you're right. There will be some of that. And some of the people, I watched some of the evacuees as they were leaving and we interviewed some of them. And many of them did say, you know, this was my dream vacation and, you know, I'm going to come back. I'm going to come back because this was what I wanted to do my whole life. Mm. So you get a sense of that from people.
Maybe we should move on from the deck chairs of tourism, but just also the political deck chairs. And I'm wondering who will succeed on the opportunity front. And I mean, this is, you know, there has been such a, you know, a shift. I mean, we look at the role that, let's say, can we talk about Al Jazeera, but also, you know, behind that, the role that Doha played in all of this, you know, as well. Do you see a bigger role for Ankara, you know, within this? Because again, you talk about the Egyptians and just the sheer number of, when you suddenly, and certainly, you know, listening to the World Service, you know, the number of Turks out there working, the number of Turkish engineering projects that you just didn't even realize that they were leading. Who becomes, let's say, the new players in all of this?
Qatar has been sort of a player and continues to be a player, and it's still stable as far as we know. And so that has definitely emerged as a country that has its hand in just about every pie. They're media savvy, they've got a lot of money, and the authorities there care about the rest of the region, and they tend to side on the side of what the people like. For example, in different conflicts, like with Israel and Gaza, or with Lebanon and you know, between Hezbollah and Israel, that kind of thing, they always seem to tend to listen to what the street is saying and agree with that. The Turks, of course, won a lot of points because of, you know, that whole issue back in 2009 with the flotilla of aid that went to Gaza. And so again, the Turks are kind of, they've made a comeback. You see pictures of Erdogan, you know, hung up in little towns in Beirut and Lebanon and elsewhere. And so I think you're right. Those are the two countries that sort of maybe now might be vying for sort of a supremacy in the region. And if you look at who's visiting who, that also gives you some clues. I mean, our foreign minister, I mean, within very shortly after Egypt fell, was in Kuwait, and our governor general was in Qatar. So it kind of gives you a sense.
When you say we were talking about as Canadians.
Canadians, right. Sorry. Us as Canadians, correct.
Sorry, Andrew, Rob, you don't have a governor. You don't have a governor general here.
I don't. I'm left out.
Yes, you just got a queen. That's all you've got.
That's right.
Andrew, just on that point, when you look at Al Jazeera sort of being, you know, the mouthpiece for, you know, for Qatar and also, you know, very much a global player, do you feel that also, you know, the relationship that the Foreign Office has or continues to have, you know, with the World Service as well, that I got the sense that they were really sort of wanting to sort of say, okay, look what we're doing, you know, look what Haig is out doing, you know, look what the PM is out doing, and almost trying to get sort of, I think, sort of the brand Britain message out as a serious, you know, foreign affairs player.
Well, and certainly Cameron was quick to kind of get over there as well and kind of show his face. But what's interesting is, as you said, that in fact the British did just look out of step. They didn't know quite what was happening. And then this kind of, you know, Gaddafi is already in Venezuela, kind of, you know, these ideas that they were kind of, you know, they were almost picking up on Twitter feed themselves and passing things on. It didn't seem very referenced and it didn't seem very credible. And then they were very slow off the mark about getting kind of the British out. It just hasn't been their finest moment. They don't seem to quite know how to have played it. And now, obviously, in the last few days, they've gone in much kind of heavier about and aligned themselves with America's aspirations. But it hasn't been their finest moment.
Mm. I mean, within all of this, and of course, you know, Al Jazeera keeps on coming up. If you look at the other Middle East networks, let's say, you know, Al Arabiya, for example, you know, are they also sort of not sitting on the sidelines? I mean, they've been very much in the throng as well, but saying, God, you know, next time, you know, we're going to go out and, you know, and get our big exclusive, and we're going to be a bigger player. And maybe as much as you're saying, Andrew, as well, that also maybe the BBC had to step up its game earlier in the week, you know, getting the sit down with Gaddafi, for example. Does Al Jazeera continue to sort of, you know, yeah, certainly put the wind up everybody?
Well, I mean, Al Jazeera, as you know, has upset a lot of people among some of the regimes. They've been kicked out of a few countries because they sometimes, you know, say, quote unquote, the wrong thing when they're trying to do, you know, journalism and that kind of thing. But what happened with Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera in Egypt was really interesting, because Al Jazeera was immediately painted by the pro-Mubarak people as the pro-Western network. And so Al Arabiya actually got a boon out of that, because Al Jazeera was kicked out, right? Mm. But Al Arabiya, in my opinion, as I was watching, actually was on top of the events in a better way. Mm. And it seemed to be, at least on that story, and not saying on every story, seemed to be a bit more neutral. However, their sources seemed to always be on the regime side. They knew what Mubarak was doing before anybody else did. And they knew what, I mean, before Al Jazeera too. And that's interesting. So that, and they are known to be sort of linked to Saudi Arabia, right? So people notice this stuff. The Arab world, the Arab people do notice these things, and they know who they're watching and they know where it's coming from.
Mm.
Yeah. I was interested. We're running an interview with Hisham Malem, who's the Washington bureau chief for Al Arabiya, and he said that an average sort of politicized Arab family, you know, is flicking through 500 channels of satellite television in their homes, which was a statistic that amazed me. Yeah. And I guess that is the thing. I think there's a huge amount of knowledge and of self knowledge when you have that amount of stuff to flick through, and knowing perhaps the color and persuasion of each of those channels.
It's very true,
and makes it a phenomenally subtle media landscape as well.
Very true, and in Lebanon, it's a microcosm of that. There's several stations there. And again, if you really want to know what's going on in Lebanon, you've got to watch every single one of them. Every single one to actually get a modicum of the truth.
Absolutely. And also, you have to have blue as the graphic identity, because I don't know who we were talking to, but they said that's why Sky News is actually quite popular and, you know, is sometimes sort of a default sort of channel of choice for a lot of Arab families, just because the blue actually looks, you know, quite nice in the rest of the sitting room.
Really? So there you go. I had no idea.
A little bit of branding to you, Nella Hyde from the CBC. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
You're listening to Monocle Weekly. We're back after this. Monocle Weekly here in London now. A radical new report entitled The Future for Architects was launched earlier this week by Building Futures, the think tank of the Royal Institute of British Architecture. Focusing on how the demands of the global economy have transformed the practice of architecture, the report asks, who will design our built environments in the future, and will architects exist in 2025? Dickon Robinson is chair of Building Futures, and he joins us now in studio, along with our design editor and architecture editor, Hugo MacDonald. Welcome, Mr. Robinson.
Thank you.
I guess, obvious question though, but the starting point for this, I mean, it's obviously something that you're charged with every day, but, it's quite a big think to look at 2025 and why this report?
Well, we exist to look 15, 25, 50 years ahead. We're interested in what's coming over the horizon, whether those are challenges that we need to prepare for or opportunities to grasp. And the RIBA is a public interest charity, actually, and it's there to try and make sure that the profession it represents can optimise its contribution to society. Looking ahead, thought leadership is an important part of that.
Mm. One could probably argue that a lot of this has already come true, though. And I say this when you drive through cities like, well, Hugo, we were recently in Seoul. You know, you look at a lot of developing economies, it's certainly things that are just off the plan. You know, architects have not been involved in these probably for decades when you look at a lot of traditional structures that are out there.
Absolutely. But I think we have a particular view of the world based in this country. And when you go abroad, you think, wow, they do things differently here. How interesting. Mm. I mean, actually, a lot of British architects are working abroad, but it's a relatively small part overall of the
profession's fee income. What we're saying is that the impact of globalization is that there are fantastic opportunities out there. The world's population is expanding enormously quickly. Our society globally is urbanizing. There's a vast need for buildings. Somebody has to design them. And architects ought to be absolutely engaged in that process. But they won't be unless they put themselves out energetically to grasp those opportunities.
Mm. Is it a question then that British architects have become quite lazy over the past couple of decades, do you think?
Well, I wouldn't say it's become lazy. I think it's had an extraordinarily rich run for the last 15 years, what I would describe as the sort of millennium boost, if you like. It's all over now, and we're back to normal, I think, is probably what I would say. But, I mean, the other side of globalization, of course, is that we are a substantial market, and we've already got lots of big American practices here. We've got a number of very good Australian practices with offices in this country. I think we feel that other parts of the world might well see us as a market that's worth having a go at. And we say, you know, why wouldn't Indian firms or South Korean firms be here? They're big enough. They're competent enough. There's no difference, I think, in the level of professionalism nowadays.
And do you welcome that? And perhaps that's what's needed, this level of also competition on your own doorstep here.
I think it probably has to be a good thing because it'll put our homegrown talent and test it and put it into a more competitive position.
Mm. It's perhaps a little bit frightening at a time when, you know, the narrative is really, about austerity, and we've seen, you know, no shortage of projects, if not cancelled, they've certainly been mothballed, you know, for the foreseeable future. So, you know, is the view of the report as well that most firms, you know, need to, you know, certainly have a regular traveler's pass on the Heathrow Express because, you know, they're going to have to be flying to really win business and, of course, stimulate their studios back home?
I think it's twofold, because I think the bigger question in a way is what is an architect and what does an architect do? What is the definition of architectural services? And a number of the people we spoke to said that they thought that the title architect was actually becoming rather unhelpful because the world has an image of what an architect does. And they felt there were lots of business opportunities out there for them that people didn't want to give them because they felt it wasn't actually what architects did. And so some of those practices are beginning to label themselves rather differently. And I think that's what is the really interesting thing about globalization and the opportunities in other markets, because they may not be asking for traditional architectural services. What they are asking for is well-informed, dynamic, creative people to come and engage with their opportunities and their challenges. And I think just falling back on a definition of the architect as we have in this country, as protected by title, is not a helpful thing in relation necessarily to the opportunities elsewhere.
I mean, Hugo, do you think clever architecture firms have already done that? Or you know, whether it's firms or individuals, but that they've already refashioned themselves and they're also marketing themselves already differently?
Absolutely. And I think the younger generation of architecture firms are much quicker at adapting and thinking, these are areas where we can diversify and get ahead of the competition and also keep working on home ground. But how much does training sort of play a part in that? I mean, architecture training is incredibly rigorous. And is it a question that education needs to catch up and sort of open up these opportunities to a younger generation?
I think my sense is that one of the areas where architectural education has been weakest is in the idea that architecture is a business as much as a vocation or a calling. And so, I mean, architects do a huge amount of free work. I know of no other profession that would do so much free work on the hope that it might turn into a substantial commission. And architects have actually got to be much more businesslike, I think, if they're going to actually survive in the world which is evolving.
Do you think it's interesting when you look at architecture from the public's perspective? I think that architecture is still seen as concentrating on the prestige, on the bigger developments even now, even in these times when there is kind of less money around. Do you think there's a way, in fact, that architects haven't been very good at marketing themselves or perhaps even targeting the kind of the more interesting kind of projects for globalisation, you know, actually mass affordable housing, structures which are are actually maybe temporary or structures which are more affordable. There seems to be a whole kind of level of architecture that isn't kind of glamorous, it doesn't kind of get picked up by companies. And I wonder if that's the kind of growth area for some of these companies in the future.
I would agree with that. Of course, you can always find individuals who are doing exactly what you've just described.
But it's always funny, it's an individual. It never seems to be broad enough across the market.
But I think there is a kind of public perception, which is actually, I think, partly fomented by their competitors in the UK construction industry, which is that, you know, architects cost you money, that they've got their own agenda, that they're only for prestige projects. Whereas, in fact, I think the interesting thing about architecture is that architects are trained to think spatially. That's what the training is all about. It's not like everybody else who's trained to think numerically or in terms of verbal skills. They're trained to solve problems in spatial terms. And I think that gives them an ability to bring a very fresh approach to problems and challenges elsewhere. And it's that which we need to exploit and to get across. That's what is so creative about it. That's what's special about it. But unfortunately, their roots in master builders, I mean, after all, our great cathedrals were all designed by somebody. We would describe those people as architects, but in fact, actually, they were regarded as master builders in those days. And there is a real issue for architects as being seen as practical people as well as ideas people.
Mm. If we we have a headline view of the report in front of us, but what would you say are some of the, and certainly from a consumerist perspective, two or three of the key findings that you've pulled out of this in real headline terms?
Well, I think we think that architectural firms are going to get bigger, the more successful global ones. We think that, from what we've been told, that some of the practices which are most focused on design may find the going toughest going forward. There will be more integration of architects in the construction sector. And what we're impressed by is the number of people trained as architects who've gone off and got jobs elsewhere in the construction industry, who are now running big construction companies, running big cost consultancies. So the evidence, I think, to us is that the future is probably very interesting and bright for people who train as architects, but that may not be quite so true of traditional design-led architectural practice. Mm. 30 or 40 years ago, half of all the qualified architects in the country were directly employed by local authorities. That is now less than 10%, probably more like 5%. So there's no reason why we shouldn't see such radical restructuring in the profession over the next 40 years. Just assuming that today's situation will just continue indefinitely would seem to be rather naive.
Mm. Dickon Robinson from Building Futures, thanks very much. And Hugo, good to see you here. Thanks very much. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in London. We're back with culture in a moment. You're back with The Monocle Weekly in London, where it's culture time with Robert Bound.
I was just doing a drawing.
Well, yeah. Okay. No. Say it with pictures.
It's more of a sketch. Yeah, exactly.
What is that, actually?
I've written down the word fixers.
Okay, fixers. There's a story on fixers. It's actually good expo, isn't it?
Yeah, fixers. Yeah.
Fixers around the world.
Mm. Not fastenings, not like a drawing pin versus a bulldog clip.
No, not like Hugo's story on buttons.
Oh, I can't wait for that.
Radio 4 contact him. They want him to do actually a monologue on buttons.
That's good.
I know.
Not buttons on your trousers.
No, exactly.
Oh, what sort of buttons?
I think it's nice to press a button to make it do something rather than kind of like swipe your hand or.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I quite like that.
Yeah. But you like buttons on your trousers too.
I've got buttons on mine. I've got buttons rather than zip today.
Should we just have a small poll? Buttons or zip? What do you prefer?
Buttons.
Andrew?
Well, on jeans, I quite like buttons.
Well, I think it's because there's associations that sometimes that a jean with a button is just a better jean. It's not so much about the fasting, is it? You just think, okay, someone who's a button denim wearer, or at least the designer, they put a little more thought into it.
Yes, and there's, I think they look too many, like often like those jeans that look like slacks have zips in, a bit kind of bit ladylike.
The elasticated trouser.
Yeah.
Stretch I've got a fabric. Zip in my jeans today. Do have they you? Look ladylike?
I didn't want to say.
I think it's only the fringing that makes them look a bit ladylike.
The tassels. the embroidery on the back pockets.
When I was in in the States a couple of weeks ago, there's all of these infomercials for pajama jeans.
I've Ooh. Seen them. That's very, very good.
Pajinas.
Yeah, goodness.
They'll be in touch with me, won't they?
Yes.
This is what's going to happen.
Exactly. You're going to get a box sent to your desk.
I am.
Okay, let's go back to culture.
I thought that was enough culture.
I think it was.
I'm finished. Let's go.
Yeah. Dissertation on denim.
We've got a song from Gruff Rhys today.
Gruff Rhys?
Gruff Rhys.
Gruff Rhys.
He's from Gwynedd. That's in Wales.
It is. Sounds very Welsh.
Yes, it is.
Joe, it was St. David's Day earlier in the week. Happy Wales Day.
Happy Wales Day. Our producer's Welsh. What does he think? So he was and is still is the front man from a band called the Super Furry Animals.
Super Furry or Super Fairy?
Super Furry.
Because I would sort of think Super Fairies if I was thinking, not about our producer that he's from Wales, but just sort of... Never mind. Let's just play the song.
Let's just play the song. Waterfall from heights unknown in the universe. What matters is what happened to you. I like that horn. Horn bit, it was a bit surprising.
The sax. Was it a sax?
Hmm.
Wasn't a trumpet.
Did it put you in the zone?
It did. I mean, I'm not going to... I don't think it will get me in the zone.
But once you're in the zone, that's
it's fine. Yeah, once I've hit the zone, I can work with that.
Okay, that's good. And that song's called Vitamin K, and it's from Hotel Shampoo,
It's perfect for getting in the zone, then, isn't it?
It's good, pretty good, yeah.
Yeah.
But what do you think Vitamin K does? Is that something you might take before a run?
Is it K for keratin? I think it helps you with my tan, doesn't it?
it's hitting the spot.
Andrew, do you like that? Or is it a bit too mellow moods for you?
Yeah, a little bit too laid-back rocky for me, I'm afraid.
Wow.
Okay.
Andrew's on his rowing machine. He doesn't like listening to any Gruff Rhys on his rowing machine. But anyway, well, I will be.
I wonder what rowing machine sales are like these days.
They were quite big in the 80s, weren't they?
Huge, a rowing machine. Absolutely. A Tunturi rowing machine. I can remember the brand because we had one.
Did you?
Made in Finland.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
All those basements, all over up and down the country.
You can presumably, in there, you can have sort of like different levels of resistance, ice breaking mode, summer
rowing mode.
Yeah, exactly. The different types. Different cogs.
Still lakes in Karelia.
You see, you could only have them in houses in Canada and things because they would be too big for an English house. You could never have got one of those rowing machines.
No. You'd have to sleep in it as well. You'd have to take the oars out and sleep in it.
Actually, speaking of English households and your hometown, Bracknell.
But why are we going back to
Bracknell? You know what's interesting about Bracknell is...
I know everything that's interesting about Bracknell.
Well, I didn't realise that that's where Waitrose is based.
Oh, do you know, you don't know, Bracknell is the centre of the universe. It's BMW in the UK. It's Waitrose is based there.
Yeah.
Although, oddly, they closed down the Waitrose store in Bracknell.
Did they?
Yes, It used to be the home. It used to be the home of the Met Office, ICI.
Right.
Well, actually, when it was
kind of the original Aerotropolis, wasn't it?
It was when it was built. It was a new town. It was a piece of like 60s. You know, it was going to be solving the problems of London, but it didn't.
I believe they've taken away their Waitrose. That's sort of like. It's like kind of bombing the cathedral, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. That can't happen anymore.
That could be a song, couldn't it? They've taken away my Waitrose.
They definitely could.
Let's work on that.
Let's put a sax on it.
Rob Baum, thanks for culture. Andrew, thanks for that little tutorial on Bracknell. You're listening to the Monarch Weekly. We're back after this. Welcome back to the Monarch Weekly. Now, earlier we heard how architectural practices are set to change over the coming decades, but what will the metropolises of the future look like? One book out this week thinks it has come up with the answer. Aerotropolis, The Way We'll Live Next, looks to the future and proposes a blueprint for the cities we'll need for the next phase of globalization. And joining us on the line now is the co-author of the book, Greg Lindsay. He's on the line from New York. Hello, Greg.
Hello, Tyler.
Well, a lot of people, of course, talk about living in the air and are resident on aircraft. So if they're not doing that when they touch down, are they going to be having flats and certainly businesses around Dubai or around Incheon? Is that the way the world's going to look?
Well, I think for many of the cities that exist now, what we really need to do is sort of pay closer attention to our airport infrastructure. I mean, traditionally, cities in America and in Europe have sort of built their airports at the periphery and then sort of dump things along the edges, thinking of sort of a no man's land. And I think, you know, now that globalization is sort of, you know, increasingly realized in places like Asia and that its global connections have become more important, I think that what we really need to do is sort of appreciate the connectivity these places embody and sort of start cleaning up those areas and build more offices, more transit, to actually sort of make these places that are useful and, if not beautiful, to live in, rather than sort of, you know, wastelands on the edges of our cities.
I mean, it sounds like, if anything, this is a bit of a cautionary tale or certainly a blueprint for America's major hubs.
Well, yes. I mean, America is the worst offender in this regard. I mean, Americans basically sort of treat, you know, air travel as a necessary evil at best. And, you know, developers refer to airports as the ultimate Lulus, locally undesirable land uses. But, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, in the case is true in Europe as well, that, you know, for 30 or 40 years, you know, despite planners' best efforts, we've seen cities grow in the direction of airports, and we've seen sort of cities, entire cities, merge together. In the case of Dallas-Fort Worth, for example, despite our attempts to keep them separate. So, rather than sort of continue to resist this trend, when we know the value of these places, you can see it in rents, you can see it in housing prices, you can see it in all these sort of indeterminate factors, we really need to sort of treat this seriously and sort of set about repairing, you know, the urban fabric around our airports.
I mean, if one could argue that that certainly that Canada and the U.S. are probably a little bit out of the game at the moment, is there a danger, and certainly the city that we're sitting in at the moment, it almost seems like our new government hates airports and yet sort of don't realize that they're also, you know, going to be and are hand in hand with global trade. So I'm wondering, from a European perspective, you look at London, you know, Schiphol's got plenty of runways, debatable what's going to happen in France, but, you know, does Europe also need to up its game as well?
Well, I think, I mean, London's a fascinating example, and London is sort of the nexus of several different trends. I mean, one of which is the whole notion of which is more important, you know, GDP and job growth or sustainability and climate change. I mean, part of the UK's airport policies come into conflict with its cap and trade and its environmental policy, and I think that's certainly one reason, you know, why the Cameron government chose to cancel Heathrow's third runway. But to me, it's also interesting is that you can sort of see the divide between national governments and city governments and sort of the divide between the agendas of the two. I mean, London is a fascinating example where, you know, where the Cameron government is sort of very eager to build out its national high-speed rail network to link the north and south. But then you have Boris Johnson, who, you know, would like to scrap Heathrow, but has proposed instead a gigantic new airport in the Thames Estuary, because Johnson is willing to do anything it takes to keep the city a sort of prime financial hub and keep it well connected to the world. And Ken Livingstone felt very much the same way. He referred to London as a Singapore of the West and really saw it as a world capital and not even the capital of England. You know, on the continent side, it's sort of interesting as well, where, you know, you've seen these tie-ups between, you know, BA and Iberia to make Madrid more of a global hub. And, you know, the fear is that businesses may choose to relocate, you know, to more around Madrid if they're able to get better connections, especially to emerging markets. So you sort of see this trend or these battles between, you know, economic dominance and continued dominance versus, you know, sustainability and sort of livability.
Greg, hi, this is Rob in the studio with Tyler. I had a question about the aesthetics of this. You go into the political and economic and sort of infrastructure arguments in the book. Aesthetically, what do you see? What do you see these sort of incredibly well-connected airport cities? What do they look like?
Well, the answer is they can look like anything you'd like them to be. I mean, one of the most interesting examples in the book is Songdo International Business District is its full name, which is a city being built from scratch off the coast of Korea, linked by a 7-mile bridge to Seoul Incheon's airport. Basically, there the architects set out to build, you know, a city the size of downtown Boston from scratch. And rather than try to build a perfect city, they basically sort of borrowed signatures from different cities. So it's like the Manhattan Street Grid in Central Park, and sort of a Sydney Opera House-esque performing arts center, and, you know, a canal that's borrowed from Venice, and sort of created this hodgepodge of urbanism, which, you know, is very sort of functional. It doesn't feel totally awful. You know, it feels like it will be a real place when people live there. But on some level, it's generic. It's sort of a totally sort of indeterminate place. And, you know, I think one of the interesting trends that the sort of book tries to capture is you know, the world is about to experience another surge in urbanization. I mean, I read a statistic by the Lincoln Institute that, you know, the urban footprint of Earth is going to double in 19 years. So what it really raises the question of that perhaps a sense of place and a sense of distinctiveness is going to be the ultimate luxury in the 21st century, and we're going to have all of these places that sort of resemble what we already know at best.
I mean, with the tie-up that we're seeing right now in Latin America, Tam and Lan Chile, about to join forces. It does seem then, whether it's going to be Sao Paulo, whether it's going to be Santiago, that there must be sort of developers and also urban planners and certainly mayors, as you mentioned, who are probably wringing their hands, saying we need one of these, just like the Koreans have done.
Absolutely, or even more basic. I mean, Brazil is having a small crisis at the moment where they realize their airports are hopelessly out of date and too small for the World Cup and for the Olympics after that. I mean, they're experiencing a sort of crisis of connectivity as we speak. But, yes, I mean, there are certainly mayors who need connectivity. I mean, in places like Dubai, for example, I mean, that's the ultimate case where they literally build a city and an entire civilization sorts from scratch, basically around Emirates Airlines, which is 25 years old, and then use that to sort of, connect India to China to Africa and sort of create this sort of global trading hub. And so, you see the purest cases of using air connectivity to basically sort of hijack trade routes and try to basically fight your way into the global economic order. I think that, as I said earlier, the challenge for places, that have these hubs already, it's a question of sort of reconciling them with the greater urban fabric so they're just not terrible and not broken as they are in so many cities.
Greg, it's Andrew here. Is there a chance here for kind of second and third tier cities, that if you had a great urban mayor or an urban mayor who was very keen on bringing in this infrastructure for a smaller city, is there a chance that, like a Marseille or a Cologne could actually start beating some of the bigger players if it started integrating, an airport more into its kind of urban structure?
I think so. I mean, there's a few interesting cases. I mean, one is Bangalore in India, which used outsourcing. In the beginning, there was the outsourcing companies, and that sort of led to increased air traffic internationally, especially as their various clients came to Bangalore, which led them to build a sort of new airport and increase connectivity as India's domestic airlines built out. And now, interestingly, like Bangalore is sort of becoming a medical hub as well. A lot of the hospitals there are trying to build up their medical travel practices and sort of connect into the sort of larger trading networks. And I think even more interesting is Barcelona. I mean, there's a case, in discussing high-speed rail and high-speed rail versus air travel, as many people put it. I mean, basically, air travel and high-speed rail are complementary. They're not substitutes. So when Spain opened high-speed rail corridor between Madrid and Barcelona, domestic travel fell 40% and has been falling ever since. But what's interesting is the Barcelona government reacted not by curtailing air service, but they actually bought a stake in their own airline, and they opened a new international terminal, and now Barcelona is starting service to Buenos Aires and Singapore. It's using the opportunity created by high-speed rail to sever itself as Spain's second city and sort of assert itself as a global city in its own right. And I think that's really the potential here for cities like that, for smaller and mid-sized ones.
Greg Lindsay, co-author of Aerotropolis, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you. Andrew, do you want to live in an Aerotropolis? I do.
Well, I don't like the name. I don't.
You don't want it to be resident.
No, I don't. The word Aerotropolis doesn't sound very appealing. But I do. I like the idea that there's a connectivity between what the function is of an airport and a city. Because when you land somewhere, if you've ever been to Kuala Lumpur, that the disconnect between what the airport is and the city is it's a 2.5 hour drive or something. And you think this doesn't serve its city. It doesn't serve itself. It doesn't function. So you want that some kind of interrelation between the two. But I guess if you live on the flight path right underneath, you might not be so keen.
Mm. Rob, you?
I want it to be called Jetville.
Jetville, yeah. Right,
nice. It might be called in the 1950s.
Better than Propville.
Better than Propville. Faster than Propville. Noisier than Propville, anyway. Yeah, exactly. I think it's a great idea. It's a great idea for a book, but I find it slightly frightening as well. Mm. But in order to, as you said, in order to make this work, you have to sort of build from scratch, and you take a Venetian canal here, you take a sort of a piece of iconic Sydney Opera House-esque architecture there to make it feel like a place worth living in.
And it's funny, when referencing what's happening around Incheon in Seoul, you just have to be on approach, and you see this archipelago of skyscrapers and everything that's going up around there. And I think sort of at the best of times right now, the Korean developers aren't great at doing human scale, and it all looks a little bit frightening.
I guess in a way for us, an interesting example is City Airport with Canary Wharf. Yeah. That is a mini Aerotropolis. That's where you see an airport and its kind of infrastructure functioning very well. That it's 10 minutes from the door of your office to being on a plane, and yet somehow it doesn't seem to kind of impact on the quality of life of the people around too much. In fact, it's kind of opened up that whole area. So. Mm.
And yet, it doesn't really look like Aerotropolis on approach into Heathrow, all of those, especially if you're sort of heading westbound over all of those red brick semis. Maybe it was a vision of it once upon a time. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. back with Monocle Weekly, where it's almost time to say goodbye and wrap up our... It's a bit of an urban design theme this week, isn't it?
That's how I like it.
Working our way back, Bracknell, Aerotropolis, Aerotropoli.
Jetville.
Our producer, Alexander Mills, went down to Chatham House this week where they were looking at the future of cities and what's going to happen. Here's his report.
This week, London played host to an international conference boldly titled The Future of Cities. 100 delegates from policymakers, academics and urban planners to ambassadors and city officials engaged in 2 days of debate at London-based think tank Chatham House. The focus was on finding solutions to the challenges facing global cities as they expand at a rapid pace. Opening the conference, Dr. Johan Hahn, Commissioner for Regional Policy at the European Commission, set the tone by emphasising the need for cities to cooperate, not compete with each other. He urged regional cities to develop urban and metropolitan networks to achieve mutual economic and infrastructure gains, citing the Øresund Bridge linking Malmö and Copenhagen as a win-win success story. He also said that increased self-governance of cities will be crucial to their future growth and looked to the city-states such as Berlin and Hamburg as important case studies. The theme of shifting powers from national to city level and in turn the growing influence that city mayors will have was a recurring theme of the conference. I spoke to Para Khanna, director of the think tank New America Foundation, at the conference.
We know that city economies are by far the dominant component of a country's GDP. So it stands to reason that they would start to take on a greater political character. And indeed, what I see is cities practicing their own diplomacy. In my New York City, Michael Bloomberg, the mayor, really does conduct his own foreign policy. He uses his own intelligence service, police service, financial policy, climate strategy in networks with other cities, other mayors, and so forth to get the job done, to manage his city. And I see that as very symptomatic of things that are happening elsewhere. Already there are so many countries where the next best job beyond mayor is to be the president of a country. That's why Jacques Chirac went from being mayor of Paris to being president of France. Ahmadinejad of Iran was mayor of Tehran. And around the world, I've seen that now national governments are getting wise and either appointing mayors who are political allies or preventing mayors from taking on greater ambitions by being able to sack them arbitrarily if they were to, you know, grow too big for their britches.
The future of how we run our cities will also be impacted by how they grow. As cities expand and in many cases merge into one another, more and more urban corridors are being created, such as the Tokyo-Osaka-Kyoto region. This in turn creates new powerful political centres that could act almost autonomously from the countries they belong to. Such urban corridors are already being seen in many parts of China, such as the Pearl River Delta region, and in the UAE, where Abu Dubai has become a common phrase for the area encompassing its first and second cities. And in India, the Delhi-Mumbai corridor is set to give birth to 15 to 20 new cities, all with overlapping boundaries. Perhaps predictably, comparing cities in developing countries with their developed counterparts was a popular way of making a point at the conference. Academics in attendance were quick to bring up the relationship between the levels of democracy in city governments versus how quickly they grow. Esther Fuchs is Professor of Public Affairs and Political Science at Columbia University and former Special Advisor to Mayor Bloomberg of New York City.
There seems to be a pattern here in which cities where there is a weak democratic governance structures have managed to grow at rapid paces and also have governments which invest in the infrastructure in a way that promotes economic growth. And I think this is actually a direct challenge to the developed world, to the European Union cities, to the United States, which have lagged behind in thinking about how to support urban growth. And this is also a challenge to our thinking about how do we promote democracy as the best form of governance at the same time in which we are also looking at the need to manage large urban areas and develop policies which support these populations both educationally and economically through jobs and encourages business investment.
One of the more sensitive issues examined was how cities can address the social and economic challenges of large-scale immigration. The overwhelming response from attendees was that there needs to be a radical shift in the mindsets of policymakers to stop viewing immigrants as drains on cities and instead see them as engines of growth. Recent data covering US cities revealed that in the last decade, the greatest economic growth was achieved by cities that also had the largest influx of immigrant communities at the same time. This is true of Atlanta, Miami, and New York, where the immigrant population contributed $250 billion to the city's GDP, 32%, in 2008. However, as rural to urban migration continues to rise and city dwellers now outnumber their cousins in the country, one of the most pressing challenges facing many world cities is how to foster a real sense of inclusiveness, ownership, and community among its new inhabitants so that they stay put, even if the going gets tough. Dubai learned this the hard way during the financial crisis, when a large portion of its expat community lost their residential permits, along with their jobs, and moved away, taking their talent, capital, and other resources with them. Parag Khanna thinks this can be avoided if cities can be smarter in how they make their newest inhabitants feel at home, when citizenship is not an option.
To me, stakeholdership has become a concept that's more important than citizenship. You know you're not going to be a citizen. But what is the government going to do for you? How are they going to make you feel like a stakeholder who's bought in? Singapore is experimenting with this a lot in terms of the levels and grades of immigrants that they have there. And I think they have an interesting model that other cities should look at.
However, despite all the theoretical ideas about governance, urban planning, and policymaking circulating the conference room, it was left to Andrew Borain, chief executive of the Cape Town Partnership, to remind the attendees that ultimately, cities are about people. As the event drew to a close on Tuesday afternoon and delegates returned to their respective countries, it is this one simple idea that seemed to ring most true, underpinning the rest of the conference programme. It was unanimously agreed that for real innovation and sustained growth to occur, city governments need to develop strategies that truly harness their individual demographic profiles and see their population as being their greatest assets and not their greatest threat. For Monocle, I'm Alex Mills.
That was a very own Alex Mills. That was very nice, wasn't it?
He's got a lovely voice.
He does have a nice voice. He's trying to do a bit of a Gaynor Howells, though.
Usurping.
Yeah.
Usurping
Gaynor. He's in trouble. He has to work on his vowels a bit, though.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating, actually. It's
yeah.
Very good.
Very
interesting. Especially after our... yeah, it was a very, it's a very urban planning-centric show.
It is.
I like that.
And as we're wrapping up, you're heading back to Jetville?
I'm back. I'm going back on my rickshaw to Jetville. That's the irony.
Andrew, where are you off to?
Bracknell. That's how you say it.
I thought you were going to go to Ankara. Aren't you still going to play to Ankara
I'm hoping
soon?
To go to Ankara.
So you're on standby for Ankara.
Yeah, so we're just waiting to see if all our appointments are in a nice line.
I'm not going
to
see you next week. I don't, you know, we don't even know where next week's show is coming from.
Crazy.
I'm in Singapore.
I'm in Bangkok. I'm in Hong Kong. I'm in Taipei. I'm in Seoul. I'm in Tokyo. Take your pick. Where do you want to come from? Maybe people can tweet it in.
I might be in Singapore.
Really?
Just there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why might you be in Singapore?
For the Biennale.
What day does it start?
Friday, I think. Thursday, Friday.
Oh, I'm going to miss you. Yeah, I'm going to be sort of one jet ramp ahead of you.
Should we have a new section on the show called Diary Corner? Or
exactly.
We just talk about...
Oh, well. Anyway, we'll see where we're going to be next week. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills. Our sound engineer, who is he this week?
Shelpie.
Yeah, same as every week. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, like where we should do next week's show from, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our monocolumn. And also, I think our program is still just on the air on Bloomberg, I think for another week or two. And you can vote whether you want that to return as well, or if we should go to another network, or, you know, take your pick. As I said, next week, we don't know where the show's coming from, but it's going to be somewhere in and around the Pacific Rim. But for now, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Bound.
Rob, see you at the Raffles Bar.
Yeah, see you
okay.
there.
Thanks, goodbye.